Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org.
Cyrus, at least, was prophesied to be a servant of God to do certain things, but there is no biblical warrant for making that parallel with any modern-day person, including President Trump.
You could easily argue for an atheist. An atheist tries to argue against a creator because an atheist doesn't like the idea that there's a final judgment, that they're accountable to doing what's right. They didn't deny the idea of a creator because they don't like the idea of moral rules, which they may have violated.
It would be really weird, wouldn't it, if just in 1500 you figured out a central truth? That would indicate that you've missed something. That's Joseph Smith kind of talk.
Canadian pipers love Issues Etc.
Yes, indeed, it seems strange, very strange indeed, that one would try to improve upon, I don't know what but that's what's happening here, improve upon something as great as the art that is the Sistine Chapel, one gigantic piece of art in the form of a chapel, not only the chapel itself, but the art inside that depicts the entire scope of the Bible's teaching of man's redemption all the way from creation to Judgment Day and the life hereafter. But there is a new show, I don't even know what to call it, a new attraction that is coming to Rome that is going to spruce up the Sistine Chapel. Not the chapel itself, but at least depictions of the chapel. We're going to be talking about the Disneyfication of sacred art with Joy Pullman here in the first few minutes of Issues Etc. Greetings and welcome. We're coming to you live on this Friday afternoon, March the 23rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. After our conversation with Joy, Pastor David Peterson joins us. The church will be observing the Annunciation. Now, ordinarily, it falls on March 25th. That's the day in the calendar it is set for. This year, on the 26th, because it coincides with Palm Sunday. We'll find out how you work that out in the church's calendar, what exactly it is we are celebrating. Then Pastor Chris Roseborough will be our guest. This week in Pop American Christianity Today, Kenneth Copeland claims that Jesus always wills to heal you. We'll see what Chris has to say about that. And since it's Friday, we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We've got four soundbites to play for you, and after we've played them for you, it's your turn to give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or vote at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and your votes will decide which will be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. Joining us to talk about the Disneyfication of sacred art, Joy Pullman. She's a regular guest, managing editor of The Federalist, author of the book The Education Invasion, and of a recent column for The Federalist titled, Should the Sistine Chapel, Art Museums, and Zoos Turn Themselves into Disney World? Joy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you.
Tell your story from a mother's perspective of your encounter with some Disneyfication of various venues you've visited with your children.
Well, I first started really chewing on this topic when our local zoo, and it's been one of our favorite places. We had a family membership, and we would go just about every week during the season it was open. And they started making some renovations. And one of them was, one of the first ones that was really made our experience visiting different for my family was when they installed just a whole slew of iPads in the aquarium. So, I mean, it was an indoor aquarium, and it's dark in there, so, and it's tropical fish, you know, so that the colors of the fish really pop, and you can see, you know, their underwater environment, and it's beautiful. The kids would just love to go and see these technicolor fish floating about, eating, interacting with each other. It's really mesmerizing. But once the iPads came in, and they were placed right at a kid's eye level, and, I mean, I could see the sort of justification that folks put them in. If you poke around on the screen with your fingers, you can get to, you know, selections of screens that tell you things about fish, but my little people couldn't read. So when we start, you know, after that, the aquarium experience was really ruined for us, because we'd go in there and I would say, you know, look at this fish, you know, this is an angel fish. What colors does it have? You know, just kind of the sort of dialogue that moms do with their kids to help their little brains grow and to have a nice family experience. But my kids wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't answer me. They were busy booping and beeping on this iPad screen. And with their little, they don't know what they're doing. It's not to any purpose. It's just because the screens are there dazzling them. So we stopped going to the aquarium because my kids weren't learning anything about fish. We weren't having a family experience. There was nothing of value that we were getting out of it. If I wanted to have my kids staring at fish on screens, you know, I have a Kindle Fire. We could do that at home. So, I mean, that was when, I mean, we actually ultimately dropped our membership at the zoo because I just, you know, there were increasing numbers of experiences like that where we stopped looking at animals, thinking about animals, you know, growing as a family, you know, and turned in kind of this fake facaded, like you said in my title of my article, this Disney-fied version of the zoo that really didn't produce the same sort of quality learning and family relationship building experiences we had before.
You also had a similar, perhaps to a less degree, experience with a library.
Right. And we also, I mean, both our zoo and our local public library is apparently really well nationally regarded, and I kind of agree with that assessment. They're, you know, really quality. I look for lots of old and out-of-print books, and our library system almost always has them, which was, you know, has been rare in other libraries I've used across the country. But again, our library made kind of a change. And so we'd go there also, you know, every week or two, check out books. We'd go and sit in the children's section. My kids, you know, pull out, you know, they're preschoolers, toddlers. They'd pull out a book and say, "Mommy, read this." And it was, you know, a great way for us to, again, you know, build our relationship, to read some books and have a nice family outing. And that all changed when the library decided to move. They had the computer room, and they still have a children's computer room kind of off to the side that was exclusively for computers. But then they decided to kind of sprinkle computers throughout the children's section of the library, again, at eye level. And so these computers contain, you know, so-called learning games. But really what they did was, you know how it is with those kids' toys. Even after a child stops playing with them, they'll give out occasional beeps to try to attract the child's interest. Well, these computers at eye level did the exact same thing. So we'd walk in, we'd pick out a book, we'd be just nestling in, you know, to all snuggling together on the couch to read a story. And then just then, you know, the computer would emit, you know, some electronic noises, and my kids would all turn their faces, and the little ones with less impulse control, you know, would run over there and start fiddling with the buttons. And I'm sitting there thinking, I came here to read and have, you know, quality time with my kids, and I can't even read a book in the library. You know, my kids, you know, they all wanted all of a sudden, you know, to be staring at screens rather than having a much richer, you know, learning and relationship time with their own mother at the library. So that really, you know, now when I go to the children's section, now I have my list of books, I get them, and I bring them home so that we have, you know, our reading time at home away from the distractions that the library produces. But it's really kind of a shame, you know, that we can't have that kind of experience of browsing, a more thoughtful time. It's been destroyed by, you know, imposing all these noises and these distractions for kids.
So talk about this Vatican-approved showpiece on the subject of the Sistine Chapel, a piece of sacred art that is mammoth both in its theological and its physical scale. What's happening here?
Right. So this was kind of the recent incident that made me think about all of my experiences of ruining, you know, learning and quality family time, because this last week, I'd hardly know what to call it, this spectacle. So in Rome, there is a new kind of, entertainment experience that has been created with a Sistine Chapel theme. And it has been approved by the Vatican because the Vatican runs and owns the Sistine Chapel and runs it as a public museum. And so the folks who put on this new entertainment, describe more of it in a minute, they consulted with the Vatican when they created their project. It took them $11 million, 4 years to put together this show. There we go. Show is probably the right word. You know, this show, and it includes drama, it includes actors, it includes light shows, lasers, it includes fireworks, people in flashy costumes, dance. And it's all been created by a fellow who kind of specializes in these sorts of public spectacles. He's created, for example, you know, the closing ceremonies of the 2014 Olympics. And so you can see, you know, YouTube videos of the trailer for this Sistine Chapel show, as well as some of the other work that this artist has done. And it's really exciting. It's like a crazy production. It's, you know, high production values, very entertaining, so on and so forth. But, I mean, so I was watching it and thinking, yeah, I mean, I could definitely see really having a good time at this. But it was really, really weird to basically take Showtime, you know, Can-Can Girls, and then try to tie that in somehow to the Sistine Chapel. I mean, because if your listeners haven't, I mean, I haven't seen it in person, unfortunately, but, you know, I've looked at many of the pictures of the images that Michelangelo painted on the Sistine Chapel. I've read about the story of him creating it. And, I mean, you know, one of the most famous images, of course, is, you know, God reaching out with his finger to just touch the point, you know, of Adam's finger, you know, the creation of the world. I'm sure basically everybody can call that image to mind. So the whole, you know, the ceiling of this glorious building, you know, painstakingly covered in images of completely transcendent religious images, right? I mean, creation of the world, holy cow, you know, God putting a soul inside Adam. You know, you have, you know, Jesus Christ there. You have the patriarchs. You have all these figures throughout the Bible. You have pictures of the damned, you know, in hell. You have angels. So all these glorious, glorious images, and I think there are all kinds of ways that you could introduce people into them or use them besides, you know, a visit to the Sistine Chapel. You don't have to just gaze at these images while listening to Gregorian chant in the background or something. But I do really think that this new show that is trying to talk about, I mean, there is a difference between trying to help people get into a new and different subject matter and glamming it up and basically sexing it up. I mean, it's just seems really inappropriate and, you know, out of touch to me to apply Broadway, you know, level production and you know, internet era lasers and light shows to, you know, something that is completely outside of kitsch, basically. So, I mean, if you think, you know, anyway, if you think the Sistine Chapel is a church, it's a chapel, right? I don't know about you, but it doesn't seem very reverent. It doesn't seem very respectful. It doesn't seem at all appropriate to have inside a church or talking about religious themes, the God of the universe, you know, and essentially these, even if it's expensive, it's a cheap way. It's an entertainment art form as opposed to a reverent art form. And so the two don't go together very well, and it really expresses a lack of understanding of the treasure that the Vatican owns and opens to the world.
Joy Pullman of The Federalist is our guest. We're talking about the Disneyfication of sacred art. When we come back, somebody goes to Rome, they see both the show, that is the Sistine Chapel, and the chapel itself, and they say, I think I kind of like the show better. We'll get Joy's reaction after this.
People have confused pietism with piety and dumped piety along with dumping pietism. It's resulted in a real confusion about this.
Pastor Will Whedon on his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Making the Case for Godliness.
Any thought about dealing with how we actually live our lives is regarded as being, that's law, that's what we've been freed from, we don't have to think about that. Well, no, the whole point is, what does it look like to live with Jesus Christ having been crucified and raised from the dead?
You can meet and hear Pastor Whedon Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Our cities are some of the greatest mission fields on the planet, but the footprint of the church is shrinking. We dare not shrink from our cities. Christ is needed now in our urban areas. From chaos, turmoil, decay, death, and destruction, Jesus brings peace, hope, resurrection, eternal life, and rebuilding. And you can help by being a hero for the city. Find out how at lcms.org/citymission or on Facebook at LCMS City Mission. Every city needs a hero. Capes and helmets not required.
When we make these parallels, it takes the focus off of Jesus' great redemption.
Lutherans are always saying, no, there's no one church father who gets everything right. Of course not. We're not slavishly following them.
Including Luther.
Especially Luther.
You could easily argue for an atheist. An atheist tries to argue against the Creator because an atheist doesn't like the idea that there's a final judgment.
We teach particular election. We do not teach reprobation, that is, God chooses anybody for damnation. But we also teach that when God says in His Word that He wants all men to be saved, He really does want all people to be saved.
Just a taste of the four sound bites we're going to be playing for you in the last half hour of Issues Etc. We play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We'll play them for you, and then it's your opportunity to win the LPR bundle package by voting for one of those sound bites to be soundbite of the week. In the meantime, we're talking about the Disneyfication of sacred art. Joy Pullman, managing editor of The Federalist, is our guest. Here's what I picture as a scenario, Joy, and that somebody goes to Rome, they see both the show, that is the Sistine Chapel, and they see the chapel itself, and they walk away saying, I kind of like the show better than the chapel.
Yes. Well, I understand, you know, I mean, so the New York Times, you know, wrote an article about this exhibit, and it pointed out that it's, you know, you're supposed, visitors to this actual Sistine Chapel are supposed to be, they're all supposed to be quiet, you know, but there are millions of them every single year, and it's almost always packed. So the viewing experience in person at the Sistine Chapel is already kind of a mass, rather than, it's not like they hold church services in there, you know, it's already set aside to be a museum exhibit rather than an expression of devotion to God and a, you know, human's attempt to kind of connect, you know, with Him, to communicate the things that God has communicated to us in a fresh and creative way. So I guess, I mean, there is like kind of some aspect of, well, they already kind of degraded it, you know, a bit in turning it into a museum piece, but it wasn't quite to this level. And I mean, I think that's something that is a problem when you trivialize. I mean, again, it was the same with the zoos and with libraries. I mean, I don't have anything against Disney World. I went there when I was a kid. It was a great family trip. I know lots of people go and have, you know, a really good time. There's a place for that. You know, there's a place for Netflix. There's, you know, so on and so forth. But I don't think that place is church or sacred art, you know, or it's the same thing with the zoo. You know, animals are interesting. You know, creation is wondrous in its own right. You don't have to kind of stick pink sparkles on top of it in order to generate interest. It's legitimately interesting by itself. So when we kind of do that, when we present that to people, we are teaching them that the Sistine Chapel itself and the themes it depicts, they aren't good enough. Well, you're probably going to be bored with this all kind of old junk. is the attitude that it kind of portrays about one of the world's greatest treasures. And people pick up that communication and they start to adopt it. And basically the people who they host the library, you know, reading and access again to some of the, you know, history's greatest minds, zoos with access to some of God's wonders of creation that you can't get here in our North American backyard. And those things are beautiful in itself. And the people who, you know, kind of own and curate these treasures are teaching us that we shouldn't love them for their own sake and that, you know, they kind of have to pander to our lower natures in order to put some glitter on this old, dusty, boring thing. And it's really the wrong attitude, and it's sad to see them do that when the things that they have are treasures and much better than sparkles and Disney and kind of trivialized sort of pop culture.
What did you make of the New York Times headline on the story that appeared on the 12th that was bringing the Sistine Chapel to life?
Right. Well, again, it's just what I just said. You know, if you, it seems that the reporter has seen the Sistine Chapel in person because, you know, he was able to describe the crowded experience of viewing it. The Sistine Chapel is alive. You know, you can almost not get more alive than that, except, you know, seeing these biblical themes and stories, these colossal ideas, you know, that God communicated to man over time. There's almost nothing more alive than that. And so that he doesn't get that, I guess, tells you all you need to know about his unfortunate understanding of Sistine Chapel and what it portrays.
So returning to the term Disneyfication, Disney was a genius at what he did, and he's managed to build a company that has continued in some ways to work in that direction, then in other ways kind of exploit what he began. I'm convinced completely against what he would have wanted to do. But what was he good at, and why does it simply not apply to anything and everything we want to show our children?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that he's, you know, he's good at entertainment, right? That's what Disney is, an entertainment company. And there's something that is real and good about wanting to delight people, to show them, you know, what is funny about the world, what is curious. There's something real behind entertainment, and I don't want to just be an old grump saying, get off my lawn, young folks. Especially, you know, the older Disney movies that Walt Disney himself had a personal hand in, they are very clear depictions, for example, of good and evil. You know, Snow White, the witch scared, you know, the witch is really, really creepy. She scared my kids half to death. and that is a real thing. There are real evil things in the world. So there's some truth behind the art that Walt Disney creates. And you know, you can't really, I don't think, become a big cultural phenomenon without touching on something that is really, you know, that is true about the world, about human nature. So there's definitely something there. But of course, entertainment isn't all there is to life. And we act in different modes and different environments and at different times. And it's appropriate to do so. You know, people wouldn't, I hope, you know, you wouldn't wear a bathing suit to a wedding, even if it were a beach wedding. You know, you wear something a little bit more respectful of the bride and groom and the occasion that you're engaged in. And the same thing for church. You know, you wouldn't wear your party attire to church. It would be inappropriate. It's not respectful to God and the other fellow worshipers helping direct their attention to God. So in the same way, you know, entertainment isn't appropriate for every sphere of our lives. Or it's just, you know, it's kind of like eating candy. It's great to have candy or cake or desserts every once in a while. But if we ate all of that, we'd be, you know, well, I guess we'd be what lots of Americans are, rather pudgy and diabetic. So there needs to be balance, you know, is what I'm saying. And there are appropriate places to have a Disney kind, you know, of experience. But there's also appropriate places to be reverent, to think about the transcendent themes of eternity, of damnation, you know, of our sin, of judgment, and so on and so forth. And you really can't Disney up judgment. You really can't Disney up the creation of the world. You really can't Disney up the resurrection. Those speak to something else that is a part of our human nature and, you know, our experience of history. And they deserve their own kind of modes of communication and their modes of interaction.
I want to come back just by way of illustration to the zoo experience you had. My kids, when they were young, and my grandkids now, they know cartoon animals. They can identify a cartoon horse a mile away. But when they see a real one, it's an entirely different experience for them. It's not just about learning. It's about seeing the real deal. And for me, going to a zoo with kids is about them seeing, and in some cases smelling, the real deal. Animals as they really exist, not as they are depicted in cartoons or in animation, so that they can see that there's a world here upon which the fantasy is based. And it seems to me, in that respect, there are some things we don't want to rob our kids of by turning everything into a cartoon.
Yeah, that's a really great point. You're making me think of kind of the virtual reality headsets that folks are developing. You put it on and you think you're in whatever world this set of video game developers designed. You can move in it. You can interact with it. So, of course, people have been talking for a really long time about plugging ourselves into, you know, the Matrix or various fantasy worlds in a similar manner. And, I mean, absolutely there is something that we lose when we do that, right? So if everything is cartoon, then you never are in touch with what is real. And that really distorts your understanding of the truth, right? I mean, so I grew up on a farm, and so I had a pony. And you cannot treat a pony as a plaything. I mean, you can play with a pony. I did that plenty of times. It was absolute hours and hours of fun for me to get to tootle around with my pony and wash her and train her and so forth. But you really, you know, you can't manipulate a real animal the way that you can manipulate a plush toy, a cartoon Joey stick. I guess probably people don't use Joey sticks anymore, but you know what I mean, right? There's a definite difference in relationship. There's a give and take. You have to respect the animal. You have to work with the thing that they are rather than try to push them around and be in utter control of them. You kind of have to negotiate. And so, you know, the encounter with a real animal, just like an encounter with a real person as opposed to, you know, a droid or an artificial intelligence or a robot, the more that you get in contact with the real, you know, the better you are able to function in the world as it is. You know, I mean, there again, fantasy can be really healthy. You know, it's really good for us sometimes psychologically and socially to help us think about ideas and adjust or just have fun. But again, if you spend a lot of time there, your ability to kind of live in the world as it is really becomes distorted, and that also can mess you up, you know, in your mind and your social interactions too. So again, it's kind of like with the candy. We have to be careful and have everything in its appropriate place and try to know what that place is, so again that we can be balanced and sane and healthy human beings, you know, rather than distorted human beings.
Joey Pohlman is managing editor of The Federalist, author of the book Education Invasion, and a recent column for The Federalist titled Should the Sistine Chapel, Art Museums, and Zoos Turn Themselves into Disney World? You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Thanks, Joy.
Thank you.
When we come back on this Friday afternoon, we're going to talk about the Annunciation. It is ordinarily celebrated on the 25th of March. That happens to be Palm Sunday this year. We'll talk about that confluence with Pastor David Peterson and what we're celebrating. Stay tuned. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Holy Trinity Lutheran, Garfield, New Jersey. Grace Lutheran, Naples, Florida. St. John's Lutheran, Chicago, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Unionville, Michigan. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Beverly Hills, California. Epiphany Lutheran, Door, Michigan. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California. St. John's Lutheran, Sayville, New York. Apostles Lutheran, Melrose Park, Illinois. Christ Our Savior Lutheran, Elizabeth, Colorado. Grace Lutheran, Strasburg, Illinois, and Bethel Lutheran, Thunder Bay, Ontario, Canada. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
The people of Zion Lutheran Church, East Moline, Illinois, invite you to discover the blessings that await you here. At Zion, we proclaim a gospel of free grace for all. No one ever falls too low to find forgiveness and peace with God in Christ Jesus. To learn more, visit us at zionem.com or join us on Sunday at 9 a.m. Zion is located at 17618 Hubbard Road in rural East Moline, Illinois.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
For 28 years, I had the privilege of serving as a chaplain in the United States Navy.
Dr. Dan Gard, retired Rear Admiral and President of Concordia University Chicago, on the need for military chaplains.
During that time, I was able to bring word and sacrament to so many young people and their families, our sons and daughters spread throughout the world. Truly a privilege and an honor, and today, there are other chaplains that must follow. We need more LCMS chaplains in all branches of the military. It's an incredible, amazing mission opportunities to go to places no other pastor can go, but to go with the same tools that any other pastor brings wherever he goes, word and sacrament.
You can find out more about the vocation of military chaplain at lcms.org/armedforces. The LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces, lcms.org/armedforces.